A few years back, my friend Justin Warner from Food Network moved out to South Dakota. He opened a ramen joint, and he is always posting pictures of all the great food he's not only cooking, but eating all over South Dakota. He's always telling me to come visit. And you know, one of the best ways to experience a new place is to eat your way through it. But it's equally important to live your way through it, too. And when you summer in South Dakota, you can fill up on all the lake days, hikes, rides, and small-town strolls that'll leave you with a regained sense of wonder and a hunger to do it all over again. See why there's so much South Dakota, so little time at TravelSouthDakota.com.
Ever since my mom died, I cry in H Mart. H Mart is a supermarket chain that specializes in Asian food. The H stands for Hanarim, a Korean phrase that roughly translates to one arm full of groceries. H Mart is where parachute kids flock to find the brand of instant noodles that reminds them of home. It's where Korean families buy rice cakes to make tteokguk, the beef and rice cake soup that brings in the new year. It's the only place where you can find a giant vat of peeled garlic, because it's the only place that truly understands how much garlic you'll need for the kind of food your people eat. You'll likely find me crying by the banchan refrigerators, remembering the taste of my mom's soy sauce eggs and cold radish soup. Or in the freezer section, holding a stack of dumpling skins, thinking of all the hours that mom and I spent at the kitchen table folding minced pork and chives into the thin dough, sobbing near the dry goods, asking myself, am I even Korean anymore if there's no one left to call and ask which brand of seaweed we used to buy?
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. I got some news. Next week, Mission Impossible continues with an all-new update. I'm going to tell you what the first 24 hours after the launch were like. I'll answer your questions, and I'll try to figure out where I go from here. That's next week. Michelle Zauner is an indie musician who performs under the name Japanese Breakfast. To give you an idea what Japanese Breakfast sounds like, here's the song Everybody Wants to Love You. Despite the name Japanese Breakfast, Michelle is actually Korean-American. She told Teen Vogue back in 2017 she picked the name by combining something she considers really American, like breakfast, with something she thought Americans would consider foreign. To her, that was Japan. Japanese Breakfast has released two albums, with a third coming out this summer. And for the last few years, in between making music and touring, Michelle has been writing. Now she has a memoir out called Crying in H Mart. That's what you heard her reading from at the beginning of the show. Much of it is a reflection on her relationship with her mother and the process of dealing with her mom's death. Food and its role in their relationship is a big part of that story. Michelle was born in Seoul. Her mother, Chang Mi, was Korean. Her father is American and white. When Michelle was one, they moved to Eugene, Oregon. When she was 10, they moved to a house in the woods outside the city, miles away from pretty much everything.
I think I was a bit of a lonely child, and I was very needy, particularly of my mother. And yeah, I mean, there weren't very many neighboring children nearby that I could play with, and no siblings. I spent a lot of time with my mom, who was a homemaker. I really relied on her attention. Or I think I also lived a lot in my like interior worlds.
Sounds like she also depended a lot on you. You were a big part of her world too.
Yeah, I was definitely like her occupation, even though she wasn't like particularly a coddling mother. I mean, we were very, very close. She didn't have that many friends, so I was very much her world in a lot of ways.
So when Michelle was growing up, she and her mom spent a lot of time together. And often that time was spent eating. Here's Michelle reading another excerpt from her memoir.
While she never actually taught me how to cook, she did raise me with a distinctly Korean appetite. This meant a reverence for good food and a predisposition to emotional eating. We were particular about everything. Kimchi had to be perfectly sour. Samgyeopsal perfectly crisped. Stews had to be piping hot, or they might as well have been inedible. The concept of prepping meals for the week was a ludicrous affront to our lifestyle. We chased our cravings daily. If we wanted the kimchi stew for 3 weeks straight, We relished it until a new craving emerged. I remember these things clearly because that was how my mother loved you. Not through white lies and constant verbal affirmation, but in subtle observations of what brought you joy, pocketed away to make you feel comforted and cared for without even realizing it. She remembered if you liked your stews with extra broth, if you were sensitive to spice, if you hated tomatoes. She remembered which banchan side dish you emptied first, so the next time you were over, it'd be set with a heaping double portion, served alongside the various other preferences that made you, you.
Michelle and her mom were tight, but this singular focus on each other also bred tension. In an interview with Pitchfork, Michelle said, "I was always being told to calm down, to chill out, to slow down. I was a bad toddler, a bad child, a bad teenager. I felt too big for my environment. I just had this energy of like, I want to do what I want to do." In a feature on Spotify, she says the first song she was obsessed with as a young child was Wild Thing. Michelle's feelings of isolation weren't just about being an only child living in the woods. It was also that she was one of the very few Asian American kids around. She writes in her book that she told her mom, "You don't know what it's like to be one of the only Korean girls at school." Her mom's response, "You're not Korean, you're American."
As an immigrant, I just don't think that she understood. Like, she raised her kid in America, and I certainly, like, wasn't Korean, you know? So I think that sort of anxiety, this, like, sort of dual identity that I possessed, was really confusing for me growing up, and was something that I kept trying to convey to my mother that she just couldn't understand because she had never lived through that. And, you know, I think that her way of comforting me a lot was just kind of like being dismissive, you know, like I think that was just her style of comfort, which, you know, sometimes was really aggravating.
But it's interesting, though, because on the other hand, you know, she would say, "You're not Korean, you're American." But then she would, you know, she was eager to share Korean food with you. That was a big part of your upbringing and her relationship with you. She took you to Korean language school so you'd learn to read and write. So clearly it was important to her to instill a part of that culture into your upbringing.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a big part of her, everything that she knew. And of course, I think it's a really natural desire to, like, want to share that with your kid. And it was very much something at an early age was really celebrated. Like, I think there were parts of her home country that she also didn't really like and didn't really see me in. There was this, like, real independent streak that she had that kind of went against a lot of the more, like, conservative stereotypes of Korean culture, in which she didn't really fit in. And I think that knowing me and raising me and finding that I was this very creative and very independent child, in her mind, she was like, "You are the farthest thing from what is going to be accepted over there." And the Korean community that existed in Eugene was already really small, but a majority of them were, like, really rooted in the Christian church. And I found it to be a lot more interesting later on in life that my mom really, like, removed herself from that environment because she just wasn't a very religious person. And I, in retrospect, feel like that was really brave of her because it must have been, like, very scary and lonely to, like, exit this community that you is, like, the only thing that ties you to your home and, like, your identity in a huge way, but is something that you've decided doesn't fit with you.
I can see the choice to not be involved in the church community as brave, like you say. It also sounds like it could be a little rebellious.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's another thing that I kind of learned about my mom and understood about her later. When I was growing up, my mom obviously thought I was very rebellious. And so I didn't really think of my mom as someone that could have also been like that in her youth. It was something that was, like, constantly told to me that my mom was this tomboy and that she was a bit of a party girl and, like, kind of directionless as a young adult. And it was always just, like, confusing to me because, like, my mom was someone that would scream at me if I, like, spilled something on the carpet or, like, didn't want me to ever have a sleepover.
Michelle did see little flashes of her mom's rebelliousness when they returned to Korea. Every other summer growing up, Michelle and her mom would go there for 6 weeks to visit family. Michelle describes those trips in her book. In one passage I asked her to read, she talks about just having arrived. They're at her grandmother's house. She and her mom are jet-lagged. It's the middle of the night.
At home, I was scolded if I got caught poking around the pantry past 8. But in Seoul, my mom was like a kid again, leading the campaign. Standing at the counter, we'd open every Tupperware container full of homemade banchan and snack together in the blue dark of the humid kitchen. Sweet braised black soybeans, crisp yellow sprouts with scallion and sesame oil, and tart, juicy cucumber kimchi were shoveled into our mouths behind spoonfuls of warm lavender kongbap straight from the open rice cooker. We'd giggle and shush each other as we ate kangjang kejang with our fingers, sucking salty, rich, custardy raw crab from its shell, prodding the meat from its crevices with our tongues, licking our soy sauce-stained fingers. Between chews of a wilted perilla leaf, my mother would say, "This is how I know you're a true Korean."
Michelle says as a kid, hearing that from her mom made her feel special, but it was also confusing. Sometimes her mother told her she was American, other times Korean. And Michelle didn't really feel like she fit into either. As she became a teenager, that need to break out grew stronger. She started drinking, doing drugs, missing school. She also got into music. She had taken piano lessons since she was 5, but in high school, she ditched piano for guitar, really for rock and roll. She started playing in bands at school functions, then around town at real music venues. Her parents were initially supportive, until Michelle started saying she wanted music to be her career.
I think it's like a really funny thing in Asian culture that like most Asian kids are forced into learning how to play piano or violin at the age of 5. But God forbid that you actually like become interested in music. You know, she felt like it was her duty to dissuade me from this lifestyle that was not very realistic. She never went to college. And so it was really important that I went because she wanted me to have the opportunities that she didn't have.
As Michelle writes in her book, she found out at a young age that her father was having affairs. She says for most of her childhood, he was either away at work or at the bar. Today, she's estranged from him. So that pressure from her mom to go to college and pursue a more stable career, she understands it in a different way now.
Maybe like she wanted some freedom from like not, you know, relying on my dad to provide for us. I think that she wanted to make sure I never was in that same position.
But at the time, the growing distance between them was something Michelle didn't know how to bridge. In her senior year of high school, she had a nervous breakdown, which led to therapy and medication. She writes, "My mother was convinced all of it was a direct attempt to spite her." Michelle did end up going to college, about as far away as possible, Bryn Mawr, outside Philadelphia. On the East Coast, her passion for music grew, and she was slowly starting to repair things with her mother from afar. Then her mom got sick, and their relationship changed overnight. We'll have that part of the story when we come back. Stick around.
Saute, you stay, because it's time for some ads.
Norwegian Cruise Line breaks the boundaries of global cruise travel. When you cruise with NCL, you're going to get award-winning specialty restaurants, a variety of food and beverage offerings, immersive entertainment, and the most thrilling experiences at sea. It is first class. These ships have all kinds of specialty restaurants, Brazilian steakhouse, French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Mexican. Select ships also feature alfresco dining on the waterfront and Ocean Boulevard, an oceanside promenade lined with bars and restaurants. Norwegian provides guests with truly authentic and fresh dining and bar experiences complemented by exceptional service. Almost everything you'll eat is prepared from scratch by highly experienced chefs. And they got whatever you're going to be in the mood for. You want a quick casual family meal? They've got that. You want a beautiful four-course feast? They've got that too. And you can sip something delicious at one of up to 23 unique bar and lounge options per ship. Visit and explore exciting destinations around the world and enjoy unique experiences on board. With no set dining and entertainment times and no formal dress codes, you have the flexibility to design your ideal vacation. Book your next adventure at ncl.com. I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third-generation, family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about $10 a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing, with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly. At Boar's Head, delicious is in the details. And you see that in their incredible selection of hummus flavors. Boar's Head hummus is expertly crafted to achieve the perfect balance of creamy texture and refined taste. You can taste those chickpeas. You can taste the tahini. You can taste a little bit of acidity. It's got it all. I especially love their roasted red pepper hummus made with fire-roasted peppers. You can even taste a little bit of that char. It's perfectly dippable. It's perfectly spreadable. This is the kind of thing you always want to have on hand in your refrigerator. Dip, scoop, spread, or smear Boar's Head hummus to your heart's content. Hummus so extraordinary, it can only be Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere. I just got a very wonderful shipment of goodies from the folks at Reese's. And let me tell you something. These people remain the absolute worldwide leaders in bringing together chocolate and peanut butter. Of course, we know that peanut butter cups remain transcendent. But have you tried the Reese's Sticks? They're wafers with peanut butter in between each wafer, all coated in chocolate. I mean, the combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter just brings people joy, and the folks at Reese's do it better than anyone. So shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. You want to win a copy of Michelle Zauner's memoir? Sign up for our weekly newsletter by April 30th, and you'll be automatically entered into this and all of our giveaways. We only send one email a week. Just want to give you some hot tips on what The Sporkful team is eating and reading or watching or listening to. Lots of good recs in there. Sign up right now at sporkful.com/newsletter. Now, back to my conversation with Michelle Zauner, whose new memoir is Crying in H Mart. Michelle graduated from college, stayed in Philadelphia. In 2014, she was living with her boyfriend, playing gigs and waiting tables. Then, just after she turned 25, she got the news that her mom was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Michelle moved back to Oregon to take care of her.
My biggest fear always was my parents passing away, you know, because I was alone to deal with that. And I knew that there was always going to be this moment, that there was going to be this role reversal, that I had no idea it was going to come so quickly. And, you know, of course, like so much of caretaking since you're a baby is just like making sure that someone is fed and taken care of and is nourished.
Michelle devoted herself to the task of feeding her mother, a reversal of the way it was for so long. Michelle figured she'd try to make some of the classic dishes she grew up with that her mother had made for her.
But I never really learned how to cook Korean food because, like, I never thought that I would have to figure it out so early. And on top of that, my mom was going through like really intense chemotherapy and like didn't want to eat a lot of the Korean foods that I like associate with our culture, like really hot, really spicy, really cold, really flavorful, really garlic heavy. Like you can't eat that kind of stuff when you're going through chemotherapy and everything tastes like metal and like makes you sick.
Is there a specific story you can share that you recall of trying to cook something for your mom?
You know, it was already so hard for me to like kind of think of something, but then I was like, oh, I'll make gyeranjim, which is like this, it's like actually a side dish. If you go to like a really nice Korean restaurant, they'll give you a ton of side dishes. And if it's like really good, there's this egg custard. It's just eggs and water basically, or stock. And it's like plain egg custard. And I was like, that's nutritious. That's a good source of protein. It's like very plain tasting. It's Korean. And so I made this thing I'd never made. I was so proud of myself. I made this thing. And my mom was like, I don't want that. I spent so much time thinking about this one thing. I put all my eggs, like literal eggs, into one basket. and she just didn't want it.
How did that feel when she wasn't able to eat the food you were trying to give her?
It was devastating, but it was also like fear-inducing. Like I had a real fear of failure, of like, she's going to starve to death. Like, I need to, like, figure this out. So there was a lot of panic of, oh, my God, she doesn't want to eat anything, and she's going to, like, wither away. I had a real palpable fear of that.
After 2 months of chemo, Michelle's mother decided to stop treatment. The cancer was spreading too quickly. Knowing there wasn't much time left, Michelle and her boyfriend Peter decided to get married as soon as they could, so Michelle's mom could be at the wedding.
I remember my mom's friends made kalbi, which is like Korean short rib barbecue, often eaten for like celebrations and stuff. It's very decadent. I remember my mom like tasting her marinade and kind of coaching her of like how we wanted it prepared or whatever. And that being like a special thing between us, because that was always what my mom made every time I came home from college. And so we were like kind of like trying to recreate that for this celebration.
2 weeks after the wedding and 6 months after being diagnosed, Michelle's mom passed away. How was your relationship with your mom when she died?
I think that for me, one of like the really truly heartbreaking parts of our relationship was like, it was just starting to get really good. And I think that that's like a real thing that a lot of girls when their mothers go through, where it's a very natural thing to push away from each other in your teenage years and then like really go find some distance and come and return to them with this like newfound appreciation. And so one of the things that my mom said to me that I always will remember that was really beautiful to me was, as we sort of began kind of returning to one another, she said, you know, I just realized I've never met someone like you. And I think that that was a really eye-opening thing for both of us, where we were just finally acknowledging that that maybe there was a lot that we didn't understand about each other. And so that was like a real turning point in our relationship. And that happened when I was like in my early 20s, maybe 20, 21. And so things were starting to really get great. And my mother was beginning to confide in me as a peer. I had, you know, I think a lot of people in their early 20s have this moment with their parents where it was like, oh my God, you're a human being. Like, I thought you were just like, I thought you were just my mom. Like, realize you've had like this whole other life that doesn't even involve me. And you go through like all, you have thoughts that don't involve
me. You mean you still exist when I'm not here?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like the tree that falls in the forest or whatever. There was like this time in my early 20s when my mom started like telling me about her day and her life and stopped asking me questions. Like, I wasn't the main, you know, it wasn't just her bombarding me with questions.
Right,
it was like,
right. This
is what I did today. I'm having trouble with this. And it was like, I remember having this very specific realization on the phone with her when I was in college of just like, whoa, we're talking about my mom now. You know, it's like her turn to talk to me about her life. And that was really exciting. And it's unfortunate that we didn't get to have that for very long. But I also feel like, you know, after learning about a lot of people who have lost their parents at a young age, I can be grateful at least that I got to spend a lot of time with her before she passed and really try my best to prove how much I really loved her. And I would like to believe that she really knew that. And then that was where our relationship ended.
Did she ever tell you that she knew that?
One of the last things that she said to me when we were just like hanging out in her bed a lot was, you know, as a child, you always used to cling to me. And here you are, like, you're still clinging to me. And that's always really haunted me because I feel like that was, in a way, like, her way of saying, like, you know, I always knew that you really loved me.
Her mother's death changed the way Michelle felt about the Korean part of her identity.
I could always ask questions of my mother, and my mother always made me feel like she was the tie to that part of me, and so there was nothing to question of that. And now that she's gone, I don't have that to rely on anymore. If someone were to confront me about like something that was not Korean that I did or something, I could just talk to my mom, and all my mom would have to say is, it is Korean. And I would just know that it is, you know what I mean? Because she's like, she has that kind of agency. But yeah, I think that like losing her just, you know, it was like, was a scary feeling where it's like I lost that half of myself almost. I don't have that sense of belonging anymore.
So Michelle set out to rediscover that part of herself through food. She started trying to make the Korean dishes her mom made for her. Just one problem. Michelle's mom never taught her how to make them. So Michelle turned to Mangchi.
You know what I'm going to make? Doenjang jjigae. Korean fermented soybean paste stew. First, I'm going to use potato, peeled potato, medium size, around 1 cup.
Mangchi is a YouTube star famous for her Korean recipes and videos. We had her here on The Sporkful last year. And this is a role that she's played for many people of Korean descent all over the world. We did a show years ago on international adoption, and we heard from Korean adoptees who used Mangchi's cooking videos to reconnect with their roots. Michelle did the same thing.
This is American standard, you know, measurement. I got this from IKEA, so cheap.
I found her to be so charming and effervescent and so soothing. Just her accent even just like reminded me of my mom. And like she just completely demystified this thing that felt like it had been withheld from me for a long time. And when I moved to New York a year later, I started cooking all these different dishes, and it was very comforting for me. And yeah, I just started going to Flushing and going to H Mart like every week, spending $100 on groceries and like watching these YouTube videos. It just became like this routine that was like really comforting to me, you know, and it was extremely therapeutic part of my grieving process.
What do you think made it so therapeutic?
I had so much unprocessed trauma, you know, like, I mean, a big thing I wanted to get across was like, it's really like an intense, horrific thing to watch someone die. It's a really, really tough thing to like see someone you love deteriorate their health. And that was really scarring for me. And because I hadn't spent a concentrated period of time with my mom since I was 18, it had been 7 years since I like lived with my parents. And then this was like the last 6 months I could really remember. All of my memories of my mom were like of her being sick. And that made me so sad. My mom would have hated for me to remember her as this bald woman with sores all over her mouth. And part of what was really therapeutic about it was like I would go to H Mart and I'd be like, oh my God, they have red bean. And then I'd have this memory of red bean, you know, and like the summers that we ate popping stew, or I would see like, or like I would see this can of like mackerel and be like, oh my God, I remember when my mom used to like cook this in soy sauce and sesame oil, and she would eat it while we like ate American meals or something like on the patio table. Like, and so it was like this process kind of started opening up a lot of memories of my mom that had been kind of like buried by this trauma. And I realizing that, I was like, oh my God, really drawn to like going there over and over again.
Now, Michelle has learned to make a lot of the dishes her mom used to make for her. When she goes to H Mart, she's got a long list of favorite items.
Some of them aren't Korean. I just love H Mart. I hope that they sponsor me someday. I probably spend like thousands of dollars there like every year. Yeah. But I always get, they have like a sushi section, like a sashimi section, and you can get like a big fillet of salmon, raw salmon. That's like $14. And then like you just cut it at home and you have basically $50 worth of sashimi, like just from the grocery store, which I've been into. I usually also buy Japanese mayonnaise, QP mayonnaise that has the MSG in it. It's so good.
I got some in my fridge right now. QP mayo.
I like mixing that with gochujang, which is another staple. It's like a, you know, fermented red pepper paste, Korean red pepper paste. And then my like big old man Korean thing that I love is ojingeo, which is like dried cuttlefish. And you like roast it on the gas stove and it kind of curls up. It's like cuttlefish jerky, basically. And you dip it into this red pepper sauce with the kewpie mayonnaise, and you have peanuts and beer. And that is like the ultimate old Korean man, like pub snack. And
that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's really good. And your like jaw hurts so bad because you're like gnawing and like drooling on this thing. And yeah, I've eaten it since I was a kid, and it's just like a really comforting, I love it. It's really expensive, but I am super into that. That is a big thing for me. I used to really not be into perilla leaf, and I felt like a really bad Korean for a long time. So I actually have recently trained myself to like it. So I've started getting that for Korean barbecue as well.
Okay. I feel like one of my favorites when I go, I mean, I don't know much about cooking Korean food. When I go, I love a bosam.
Oh, yeah. That's wild. That's one of those Korean things that I don't like very much.
Really?
Yeah, you're more true Korean.
Okay. I don't know if I'd say that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that sometimes it's in some places they serve it with perilla leaf. In some places they go like more Western greens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm not a big fan of it. I think it's kind of gnarly, but it might be one of those things I need to train myself to like, because I have some shame about not being into it.
Oh, well, I don't really have the authority to let you off the hook for that shame, Michelle. But if I did, I would.
Maybe I should try it again.
Michelle's grief changed her relationship with food and cooking. It also shifted something in her approach to music. In an interview with Wall Street Journal magazine, she said, "I needed to write down and figure out what I was feeling. A lot of my grief manifested in an addiction to work." Soon after her mom's death, she began recording under the name Japanese Breakfast and released two albums. The first was Psychopomp in 2016, which Rolling Stone compared to listening to a lucid dream. Here's a clip from the title track.
괜찮아.
Those last few seconds are a recording of Michelle's mother. Japanese Breakfast's second album, Soft Sounds from Another Planet, came out a year later. Here's the song Machinist.
Okay, let go.
For the first time, Michelle's career as a musician was taking off. She went on a world tour, playing shows all over Asia.
And then we ended the tour in Korea, in Seoul, where I was born and where my family is from. It was really, really special. You know, like I have one aunt left in Korea, my mom's older sister, and everyone else has died. And my aunt came. And before I went over there, I was telling her, you know, about the show and I told her like things were going well, but I don't think, you know, a lot of parents like really or like family understand like what you're doing until they get to like see what's going on, you know, that she was like being translated through my cousin. And my cousin was just like, yeah, you know, she just who pays you? You know, like, how do you get it? Like,
I get that question as a podcaster, too. Right. Yeah. Like relatives, especially of an older generation, are like, so this is a job?
Yeah. Yeah. she was like, is it an office? Like, like a company that pays you? And I was like, well, you know, people buy tickets to the show and there's like a promoter and then they like, you know, give you like some of the door or whatever. And they're like, okay. And so they came to the show and it was a really lovely moment where like, you know, the show sold out. It was like, you know, it's like huge. It was like 500 people like in Seoul, which is pretty wild. And I just said, Imo, this is like my huesa, which is like my company. And it was like a very a sweet moment. And, you know, my mom's photo is on like the album cover and like her little paintings are on the discs. And, you know, it's really something very beautiful about all these kids in Korea, like, carrying out these big cardboard squares of my mom's face out into the streets of Seoul. You know, it was a very sweet moment. Tell the men I'm coming. Tell them count the days.
I can feel the night passing by like a mistake waiting for me. That's Michelle Zahner of Japanese Breakfast. Her new memoir, Crying in H Mart, is out April 20th and available for pre-order now. Her new album, Jubilee, comes out in June. This is Be Sweet, the first single off that album. And man, I cannot get enough of this groove. Hey, we're giving away a copy of Michelle's book. Subscribe to our newsletter by April 30th and you'll be entered to win. Subscribe now at sporkful.com/newsletter. And get psyched for next week. We'll have an update on Mission Impossible. This show is produced by me along with senior producer
Emma Morgenstern
and producer
Andre Sohero.
Our editor is
Tracy Samuelson.
The show is mixed by
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Peter Clowney and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Fig in Chicago, Illinois, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.